The headlines: Hezbollah leader warns against any aggression by Israel, saying any security or military measure against Lebanon will evoke an immediate response. Foreign ministers of Iran and Saudi Arabia agree to meet soon to pave the way for the reopening of the two countries' embassies. The school shooting leaves two faculty members injured. In the state of Colorado, as gun violence continues unabated in the United States. Hello and welcome, everybody. The leader of Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah is warning against any aggression after Israel blamed it for bombing attack. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah stressed that Hezbollah is not afraid to go into battle. The Hezbollah leader warned that any security or military measure against any Lebanese area or person will result in a, quote, definite and swift response. He said the bomb attack in the northern city of Megiddo indicates that Israel is in its weakest position ever. Nasrallah also warned that a war in Lebanon could spread throughout the region. According to reports, an Israeli was seriously injured when a man infiltrated Israel from Lebanon last week and planted a roadside bomb near the Megiddo Junction. The regime's military said its forces killed the suspected bomber. Iran's foreign minister has stressed the Islamic Republic's readiness to develop and strengthen relations with Saudi Arabia. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was speaking in a phone call with his Saudi counterpart Faisal bin Farhan al Saud. He also welcomed the normalization of ties between Tehran and Riyadh. The top diplomats agreed to hold a meeting soon to pave the way for the reopening of the two countries' embassies and consulates general. Tehran and Riyadh signed a Chinese broker deal earlier this month to normalize relations 7 years after they were severed. The two countries agreed to recommence diplomatic ties and open embassies in their respective capitals within 2 months. Journalist Esha Krishnaswamy earlier told us that China brokering a deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia could have repercussions for the U.S. and Israel in the region.
What I think is that China kind of finally is ready to assert its role as the leader in Asia. And of course, Iran is a very good ally, and Saudi Arabia has been is probably the strongest ally the U.S. has ever had. And if they are able to distance Saudi Arabia from the U.S., of course, it is better for China in the long run, because the U.S. has explained how it wants to be the aggressor against China and limit China's growth. And so I think this is just the next stage. And I personally see that this is a big step, because the Saudi-Iranian diplomatic relations was in 2016 when Sheikh Nimr got executed. They cut off diplomatic relations. So this is a very big first step. And of course, the biggest player in the Middle East who's going to feel the negative repercussions from this is Israel, who already explained that they're not very happy with this deal.
Elsewhere, China's military says it drove away U.S. warship that had illegally entered its territorial waters in the South China Sea. The military said the U.S. intrusion undermined peace and stability in the busy waterway around the Paracel Islands. The military said it will maintain a high state of alert at all times. The U.S. Navy disputed the Chinese statement, saying the vessel is conducting routine operations and was not expelled. It added the U.S. will continue to operate wherever international law allows. China claims nearly all of the South China Sea, which has become one of the many flashpoints and the Beijing-Washington relationship. U.S. warships have passed through the South China Sea with increasing frequency in recent years, allegedly to counter China's assertiveness. For more on that story, international relations expert Digby Wren joins us now from Phnom Penh. Mr. Wren, welcome to the program. First of all, give us your assessment of the recent tensions in the South China Sea.
Well, this is another example of the United States testing the waters, so to speak. Look, they've gone inside the 12 nautical mile limit on the Nansha or Shisha Island. Of course, the Chinese are going to not allow that to happen. But this is there's been a series of these actions, these FONOPs, freedom of navigation operations conducted by the United States over the last few days in the East China Sea, in the Philippine Sea, and in the South China Sea. And I think what you might notice, the timing is just before Taiwan's self-ruling leader Tsai Ing-wen is about to visit the United States and meet with the House Speaker McCarthy. So this timing is not coincidental. That's going to grab all the headlines in America and then prepare the audience for the visit of Tsai Ing-wen.
Mr. Ren, talking about the timing, this also comes following Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. On that issue, what does China and Russia's growing alliance mean for the U.S. and its policies in Southeast Asia?
In terms of Southeast Asia, well, you know, of course, that concern is mostly about the Ukraine, but it does have ramifications for Southeast Asia. ASEAN, for example, has a policy on the Indo-Pacific. They're not happy about proliferation of nuclear weapons, you know, so the AUKUS arrangement between the UK, the US, and Australia, which is, you know, now going into some kind of serious planning, although nothing yet has actually happened. Look, I think that partnership, that strengthened partnership, is a partnership across all of Eurasia in real terms. And it means that the US is now only operating on the periphery, the European periphery in the Ukraine and then in the Western Pacific periphery. For the first time in a very, very long time, you can see that the bulk of Eurasia, and that includes Iran and the recent arrangement with Saudi Arabia and right across the Central Asia, is now basically much more peaceful than it has been for a long time. And so you can see that the Americans are very worried about not being able to exercise more influence in the area, and they're doing everything they can to you know, get that back. And their operations in ASEAN are really to split ASEAN if they can, which is what they've done in the European Union. And it's not welcomed here at all. I think there's a lot of pushback here to stop that from happening. And South China Sea, of course, is a sore point. But the Indonesians, who have the chair of ASEAN this year, are really pushing to get the code of conduct signed, which would, you know, enable all the countries, including Vietnam and other countries that have claims in the South China Sea, to start looking collaboratively or collectively to control and use and exploit the resources of the area. And I think that's really what China and ASEAN want.
Thanks a lot, international relations expert Digby Wren, joining us from Phnom Penh. Gun violence seems to rage on, unabated in the U.S. In the latest case, a student has shot two faculty members at a school in the western state of Colorado before fleeing the scene. The shooting happened in Denver when the 17-year-old African-American student was being patted down as part of a search for weapons. Police are trying to find his whereabouts. Officials say one of the faculty members shot in the incident is in critical condition. This is the 18th shooting at an American school this year. The country saw dozens of school shootings last year, which caused a large number of deaths and injuries. School shootings are alarmingly common in the U.S., where students are taught how to respond to an active shooter on campus. In one of the deadliest cases last May, a gunman killed 19 children and two adults in Texas. Heavy storms have been wreaking havoc in the U.S. state of California, leaving at least 5 people dead. The deaths were all caused by falling trees. The storms have brought tornadoes, destructive wind gusts, and heavy rain to the central and southern parts of the state. Several buildings have been damaged, and more than 250,000 residents are now without power. The storms have also sparked floods and landslides in several towns. Authorities have ordered thousands of people to evacuate their homes, warning that more rainstorms are on the way. The latest storms come after months of heavy rain and snowfall that battered the western U.S. state. And a new official report into the UK's Metropolitan Police has found the country's biggest police force riddled with deep-seated racism, misogyny, and homophobia. The damning report comes 2 years after the rape and murder of a young woman by a serving police officer in London. Saeed Puruza reports on that.
Black community leaders demanding immediate action to reform Britain's largest police force. coinciding with an official report into the Metropolitan Police by victims' rights and social welfare expert Louise Casey. In her 363-page report, she describes the whole force as homophobic, misogynistic, and racist. Central to her findings, the Met's failure in its duty to vet officers and protect women and children. It was exactly that failure that prompted the report. In March 2021, Wayne Cousins, a serving Metropolitan Police officer, abducted, tortured, raped, and killed Sarah Everard. Cousins was jailed for life. His conviction prompted another woman to come forward, accusing another officer, David Carrick, convicted of raping 12 victims over 17 years. Police Commissioner Mark Rowley has welcomed the report, but stopped short of admitting the force he leads is institutionally racist.
We have racist, misogynist, and homophobes in the organization, and it's not just about individuals. We have systemic failings, management failings, and cultural failings. The reason, and I respect Louise using that term, the reason I don't use it, I think it's a very ambiguous term.
On the whole, the report is condemning of this big organization, pointing to the fact that it has lost public confidence and consent, and that it has to wake up, own up to the problems plaguing it, and engage in wholesale across-the-board reforms.
Black community leaders, though, say they're concerned the reform may not go far enough.
This is just another report saying the same thing that's been said for decades now in this here country. The Metropolitan Police is institutionally racist, policing is harmful, it's misogynistic, it is homophobic. And for me as a black woman, the police, the Met Police, is an anti-black organization, anti-black racism organization.
In February, the charity inquest found that black people are seven times more likely than white people to die after being restrained by the police.
In Metropolitan Police in London, a black person, you've got 69 chances out of 1,000 to be stopped and searched. If you're white, it's 24 out of 1,000. Black people are five times more likely to be tasered than white people. You could go on and on and on.
The report is a wake-up call for the Metropolitan Police. Its author, as do these minority community leaders, says her recommendations are not to be picked from, but to be implemented. Without them, she says, the force may need to be disbanded. Saipur is up, London.
Also, the French president has defended his deeply unpopular pension reform and vowed to put it into force by the end of the year.
Oui. So
yes, there aren't 100 solutions if we want the pension system to be balanced. It no longer is. And the more we wait, the more it will get worse. And so this reform is necessary. And I say this to the French people. I don't enjoy doing this. I would have preferred not to do this. But it's also because of a sense of responsibility that I express my commitment to do this in front of you.
Macron also warned against what he called any misbehavior, saying he won't tolerate it. France has been the scene of paralyzing strikes and massive protests since the French president announced his plans in January. The protests have turned increasingly violent after Macron decided to push through with the overhaul and implement it without a parliament vote. On Wednesday, protesters blocked train stations in the southern cities of Nice and Toulouse. Macron barely survived two no-confidence votes on Monday. The pension reform law will raise retirement age from 62 to 64 and make it more difficult to attain full pensions. French opposition lawmakers have strongly criticized President Macron's remarks. Here's what some of them had to say.
He says that he respects the protesters, but he insults them, and he insults all French people in general, all those who, in virtue of the respect of the Constitution, are protesting, including those who are protesting peacefully or those who are respecting the Constitution and are going on a strike. We see that in reality he has in him an anger that he cannot get under control toward those who disagree with him.
He's an absolute pyromaniac. He's setting this country on fire. He pushes people towards entrenchment. He creates anger. He's the one who fuels the fire today, then tomorrow. He'll say that it's dangerous and that he's the order in the face of chaos. But he's the one creating the chaos. That's the problem. He has become an instrument of chaos. And that's the whole problem with Emmanuel Macron.
You know, the only thing that could have calmed all of this was to hold a vote on pension reform in the National Assembly. Now, daring to call it a victory after he bypassed the vote of the people's representatives, that seems a bit provocative or even inappropriate to me.
People in Afghanistan are marking the second Nowruz under the Taliban rule amid economic woes. They're welcoming the new year with the hope of positive changes and prosperity in their war-torn country. Rahmatullah Bahman reports from Kabul.
Afghanistan has been celebrating Nowruz, the Persian New Year, for centuries. It is usually a colorful and joyous festival, welcoming spring and a new life. But the celebration has been dampened since the Taliban's takeover in 2021 and the subsequent economic hardships. Nowruz is no longer an official holiday in Afghanistan. However, the Taliban authorities say they won't prevent people from celebrating the festival.
Our country needs working days rather than a lot of holidays. Nowruz won't be celebrated by the Islamic Emirate, nor is it an official holiday. But we won't stop people from what they do on this day either. However, we will instruct them to act by Islamic law and our values.
Despite challenges, many Afghans are determined to keep their spirits high and enjoy the Nowruz festivities. They dress up in new clothes and visit their relatives and friends. Afghan families also prepare special dishes such as hafsin, samanak, and fish. Many others plant trees and flowers to signify growth and prosperity. All in all, Afghans hope for a better year ahead, one that brings peace and joy to their war-torn country.
Nowruz is our ancestral tradition. It has been passed down to us from generation to generation. Nowruz means a new beginning, and its message is that we should let go of the past and begin a new year with new resolutions.
Nowruz brings us joy and blessing. It's reflecting the rebirth of nature and renewal of sprites. I hope God blesses this year with peace and prosperity. We look forward to witnessing the end of instability and chaos in our country.
Afghan people say they still find joy and meaning in their traditions and culture. For them, Nowruz is more than just a festival. It's a way of life that celebrates your heritage and resilience. Nowruz is a time of joy and the promise of good days to come. Wishing you a happy and prosperous new year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Nowruz Special. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the program. Dear friends, Nowruz has a rich culture. We have already talked about haftzin tablecloth and different items that are put on it. It is good to know that the Iranians make special foods on the occasion of Nowruz.
These foods remind people of their childhood and are prepared with much care by mothers. Stay tuned, please. Sabzi polo ba mahi, which is rice mixed with vegetables and served with fish, is a popular dish of the Iranian cuisine which is prepared in various occasions, especially on the eve of Nowruz. Many ancient Iranians believed that eating rice mixed with vegetables and served with fish would bring blessing, freshness, richness, and prosperity till the end of the year. In other words, fish symbolized liveliness and rice and vegetables symbolized generation, fertility and blessing. Dear friends, as you know, samanu is one of the main items of Haftzin tablecloth. This pudding is made of fresh wheat sprouts that are cooked very carefully and patiently. Fresh wheat sprout is rich with vitamin E and it is very nutritious. Samanu is the symbol of richness and blessing. To make this delicious pudding, wheat sprouts are prepared usually 10 days before starting the cooking. Family members and relatives and even neighbors gather together to stir the big pot one after the other. It takes nearly 20 hours to have a good quality samanu. But once it is prepared, you can't help eating it. Well, after a short break, we make you familiar with a custom during Nowruz in Khorasan region. One of the customs in Khorasan region is called kuze shekani. Kuze shekani means breaking of jar. A jar is filled with water and a coin is cast in it. Then the jar is given to one of the family members to throw it from the roof to break. It is believed that breaking the jar will destroy pollutions and sorrows. There is also an interesting tradition in southern Khorasan province. The family of the groom bring presents for his fiancée. These include dress, shoes, bag, rice, meat, and other things. The family of the girl in turn invites the family of the boy for lunch or dinner to bolster family ties. The people in southern Iran have their special customs and traditions in Nowruz. They fill the house with wild rose smoke while reciting the prayer for the turn of the year. They also visit the graveyards carrying sweets and rose water in their hands. Wild rue has been recommended for its antiseptic effects by physicians since old times. Dear listeners, the people of Shiraz have an interesting tradition. For your information, the city of Shiraz is famous for its bitter orange trees. The blossoms of this tree fill the streets and neighborhoods of Shiraz with their sweet smell in the first days of spring. If a tree is not fruitful, the family holds wedding for it. The wedding for the bitter orange tree is the story of a woman who wants to cut the tree of unkindness. Thus, the women of neighbors are invited and the woman of the house takes a saw and pretends to cut a branch of the tree which is not fruitful. One of the neighbors acts as go-between by covering a thin lace on the tree and sprinkling sweets on the tree and making happy moments. This way, they believe that the tree will blossom and bear fruit. Thank you. Now we take you to Yazd province in the center of Iran. Some of the people in Yazd make fire on the roofs of houses as a symbol of destroying the cold winter. Then they pour wild rue on the charcoal as a symbol of dispelling evil events. Another tradition among these people is called Koluchak. The people of Yazd put small potatoes beneath fire and eat them while singing happy poems. Dear listeners, in the end of this episode, we take you to the north of Iran. People in the north of Iran maintain a tradition called Shegin. Shegin is the local pronunciation of Shogun, meaning omen. The first person entering a house in Nowruz is called Shegin, and he or she is believed to bring good omen and blessing. This person is usually chosen from among children. Thus, Shegin brings a tray with water, coin, sprouts, and a copy of the Noble Quran. He or she steps in the room, and nobody else should enter before them. Dear listeners, many thanks for being with us.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. Now, in this edition, Chinese President Xi Jinping has arrived in Moscow on Monday, saying that his first state visit to Russia since the Ukraine conflict would give a new momentum to the bilateral ties of Russia and China. And, of course, that definitely did happen. A new era has begun, and an agreement has been signed between the two presidents containing their no-limit partnership. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss what this means for the rest of the world. But first, this report.
During a meeting with Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin in Moscow, China's President Xi Jinping explained why Russia is his first destination following his re-election.
This is in line with historical logic because we are each other's largest neighboring powers. We are also all-round strategic partners.
This is the 40th meeting between Putin and Xi during their presidency, which indicates the high and close level of cooperation between China and Russia for a long time. President Xi arrived in Moscow on March 24, a three-day visit. He began his visit with an informal meeting with Vladimir Putin, which lasted almost 5 hours. On Tuesday, the head of state held an official meeting at the Grand Kremlin Palace. The priority in relations between Russia and China is trade and economic cooperation. In the documents signed by the two leaders, they vowed to multiply the volume of trade. It is expected that the Russian Federation and China will exceed the historical record trade volume of $200 billion this year. On February 24th, on the anniversary of the start of the Russian military operation in Ukraine, the Chinese Foreign Ministry presented a 12-point plan to resolve the conflict in Ukraine.
We believe that many of the provisions of the peace plan put forward by China are consonant with Russian approaches and can be taken as the basis for a peaceful settlement when they are ready for it in the West and in Kiev, However, so far we have not observed such readiness on their part.
China and Russia, as permanent members of the UN Security Council, also vowed to uphold the fundamental norms of international relations and build up constructive force for the formation of a multipolar world.
As for sending military equipment and weapons, military cooperation, China is unlikely to take drastic steps. First of all, China acts based on its own interests, not forgetting that relations with the Western world do not become bad. Otherwise, China itself faces sanctions. Its main trading partners are still in the West.
Putin and Xi Jinping also signed two joint documents setting long-term goals until 2030 across all tracks, a statement on plans for economic cooperation and a statement on plans to deepen partnership.
The Chinese president's three-day visit to Russia demonstrates the close historical relations between Beijing and Moscow. Any agreement made during Xi's trip can be regarded as a milestone given the fact that a new world order is being shaped. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
Now, to discuss this further, we're joined by Glenn Deason, professor of political science from the University of Southeastern Norway. Also, we have with us Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, who is joining us live from Brussels. Now, let's begin with our guest from Oslo. Xi Jinping says that China and Russia should work more closely to push forward greater practical cooperation. When we're talking about practical cooperation, particularly after that no-limits agreement that was signed between the two presidents, so what does he mean?
Well, it has many dimensions. It's towards constructing what both sides would like to be a multipolar system. So it has a security dimension. It has also political objectives in terms of rejecting what Washington refers to as the rules-based international order and instead remain with international law, which is what they insist on. But more specifically, it's economics which underpins this, which means that they both countries seek to develop an economic partnership, which focuses on developing common technological platforms and cooperation between different technological hubs. They want to cooperate on the digitalization of their economies. Agriculture is a key component. They both want deepen energy cooperation. So this has primarily, at least in the past, meant a lot of gas, oil, but also within nuclear power. More LNG terminals and cooperation. We also see more cooperation within transportation corridors, not just the bridge crossings along the Amur River connecting Russia and China, but also this wider east-west transportation corridors facilitated primarily by the Belt and Road Initiative. We also have the Arctic corridor, which Russia wants to develop, in which you have maritime traffic between Europe and Asia through the Russian Arctic. And also you have huge development of new institutions, be it BRICS or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. These institutions are expanding, not just in terms of taking in new members, but they're also expanding their competencies. And of course, the Eurasian Economic Union, led by Russia, also deepening cooperation with China. And this is on top of the overall attempt to grow trade, ideally beyond $200 billion of this year alone. And yeah, to top it off, they're also working more now towards settling their trade more in dollars. So I think 2/3 of their trade is already in rubles and ones, but they would like to increase this not just among each other, but also with the rest of the world. So as Russia's made it clear, they're quite happy to accept the Chinese currency, the yuan, and also in their own trade with the rest of the world. So it has a huge, huge dimension, which is why the Chinese arrived. Well, they came for 3 days with such a large delegation, as these two Eurasian giants would like to construct a new international economic architecture as an alternative to integrating under the United States' administrative control over its format of the international economy.
Exactly, a new architecture, but that definitely will expand more than just trade and business. It will definitely have ramifications in the political sphere as well. But before we get to that, let's bring in Gilbert Doctorow. Well, Putin has also clearly said that economy and economic cooperation between Beijing and Moscow is his priority. And of course, our guest from Oslo also pointed out the different aspects of what this could spell for the rest of the world. And most importantly, what we see, Mr. Doctor, I believe, is that the U.S. and Western sanctions now mean absolutely nothing.
Well, looking at this, the results of this meeting, I have to say we know very, very little. The joint declaration, which is quite extensive, has almost nothing concrete in it. It makes reference to a 2001 treaty between China and Russia on good neighborly relations and cooperation. And like that treaty, it goes through a shopping list of many different domains where the two countries intend to develop their relations. The language of this joint declaration is what I would call, as a Kremlinologist, wooden language. It is very opaque. We have no real understanding of what took place, either in the 8 hours of meetings in 2 days, eye to eye between Putin and Xi, and the meetings of the at the minister level, a limited number of attendees, which took place each day with a different composition of those working groups each day. We don't know. This is like wartime secrecy. And it's understandable because of the hostile environment globally in which this meeting took place. But for us as analysts, it makes our job very difficult. I would like to call attention to a couple of features that we were able to tweak out from the official documents using the methods of traditional Kremlinology. In this particular case, you try to understand what took place at the working groups by looking at who took part, who was there and who was not there. There is a military affairs analyst, a certain Andrei Marchanov, who produced a rather spectacular analysis of day one of these meetings, and looking at the attendance there, not of Russia's military procurement officer, which is what the West would have us believe these meetings were about, to provide Russia with missing munitions or whatever, but with Russia's military sales director, and points us into a fact which is very important as we consider the Russian-Chinese relationship, that it is not a junior position that Russia has, but it's a fully equal position, because Russia has military hardware that China wants and needs in its own standoff with the United States. And by that, I mean the hypersonic missiles. On the negative side, tweaking the results of day two, which was in which the trade and transportation ministers were present, we have to say that the one result that was disappointing was the Chinese failure to endorse the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline going from the gas production centers in Western Siberia, which otherwise had been supplying gas to Europe, and crossing Mongolia to reach the western edges of China. That was supposed to be signed off, or many analysts expected it would be, but it wasn't. That by itself indicates that China is not too alarmed at possible sanctions or pressure being applied by the United States to it.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
let's bring back our guest from Oslo, Mr. Glenn Deason. Moscow has said that it is ready to expand its cooperation in different fields. It has mentioned gas and oil and also internet, which, of course, both sides believe now there is some kind of Western hegemony regarding internet and social media that's being used. Do you think that, unlike what happened with the Siberia 2 pipeline, we will see some more practical measures taking place regarding internet and social media?
Well, I'm not sure about the social media, but at least, well, that would imply a lot of harmonization of legislation. I'm not sure about this, but within the technological partnerships, this has been the common trend. That is, obviously, China has more advanced technology and economy, but Russia has prioritized having autonomy. That means to have its own digital ecosystem within Russia, in which the dominant companies are all local and Russian. However, having complete autonomy or self-sufficiency is not good for efficiency or to have a developed, a strong economy. So obviously Russia seeks us to have as many partners as possible. And due to the economic conflict with the West, it obviously makes sense for Russia to replace a lot of those partners in the West with China, because, well, you can't get around the fact that China is the technological leader now. But I would say that this efforts of decoupling from the West, I think this has been it's been going on for quite some time, because it's whoever controls the leading technologies, whoever controls the dominant industries, the key transportation corridors, the main banks, the reserve currency, the transaction system, the payment systems. This is what creates dependencies. And whenever you have excessive dependency or asymmetrical interdependency, in which one actor is excessively dependent on the other, you can convert this into political influence. So this is something that both Russia and China has been quite concerned about. So it is, they do see this partnership to some extent as being anti-hegemonic. So this is why both sides are seeking, again, to create new poles of power, new centers. So that means, hence, more cooperation in the area of industrial cooperation, technologies, new transportation corridors, new development banks, trade in local currencies, develop new payment systems, and effectively deprive Washington and the collective West of some of this economic dominance, which they're now increasingly using for political influence in a coercive way, I would say, not just against Russia, but against China as well. So this is quite natural. This is a balancing. And it's, well, both Russia and China has been obviously expressing the desire to be able to balance or decouple to some extent, or at least diversify away from excessive reliance on Western economies due to our economic statecraft. But now they have the capacity to do so, and especially now at the height of conflict that we are fighting a proxy war against Russia. Well, we're fighting with Ukrainians, but also now increasing the pressure and threats against China. It only makes sense that they would seek to reduce their vulnerability and their exposure towards our economic statecraft.
But still, Mr. Deason, it seems that China is trying to be more cautious than that. And as Mr. Doctor also explained, in order to wrap up this part regarding the economy and move on to the political aspects of these strengthened ties, Mr. Doctor, Moscow has also said that it is ready to increase oil exports to Beijing. Do you see any breakthroughs regarding this proposal anytime soon?
No, I don't see numbers put down. There's the ambition to raise trade to 200 million, but I would point out that trade is already in 2022 at 185 billion. So it's curious that the bar that's set for this current year is, I would say, low. The increase in trade between the two parties last year was 33%. And the target for this year seems to be 8% increase. That's not much. So what's holding it back is precisely the lack of an adequate infrastructure to deliver oil and gas in great quantities to China. And that is why the failure to sign off an agreement on the power of Siberia too at this meeting is rather surprising. The purpose of that very pipeline was to make available to the Chinese market the sources of production of gas in Yamal, in the North Siberia and Central West Siberia, which had been dedicated to supplying gas via pipeline to Western Europe. The Siberia 1, Power of Siberia 1 pipeline is drawing on what was at the time of its laying down a new source of gas in Eastern Siberia or Western Maritime Province. So the a very important possible source of increased sales and trade turnover has been put on hold. As for oil, it would be very interesting to see what kind of logistical solutions the Russians and the Chinese arrive at. Most of that oil will have to be carried by tankers. Russia is in a difficult position because of the restrictions established by the United States and picked up by other G7 members, and which means the European Union, whereby buyers or shippers who do not adhere to the limitation or the limit that is the top price set on for Russian oil and oil derivative exports, in case they are above those levels, insurance is not issued, and practically speaking, is difficult to ship. This has left Russia with a need to hastily put together a gray and fully owned tanker fleet, and it'd be interesting to see what might have been discussed between the parties behind closed doors to facilitate the increase in Russian shipping abilities for oil. Failing that, you can't increase the oil deliveries to China.
Okay, so let's wrap up the entire economic aspect of this meeting and move on to the political aspects of it. Well, of course, the Chinese president came to Moscow with a proposal to end the Ukraine conflict. So, Mr. Deason, Russia welcomed that proposal, but do you think the West and Kiev are actually ready?
Well, Russia gave a tentative or a cautious approval. They didn't agree fully. I mean, the agreement has some aspects, such as respecting territorial sovereignty, and Russia's not going to it's not going to leave these territories it has acquired, because they recognize this to be a part of Russian sovereign territory. That means Lugansk, Donetsk, Kherson, and Zaporozhye. So there's some limitations, but obviously, I think the United States has very clearly stated their objections. The diplomatic thing for the Americans to do would say, well, give us the proposal, we'll look through it, and we'll take it as a starting point. But they didn't do it. From the get-go, they said any suggestion to have a ceasefire is, according to John Kirby, was unacceptable. So they're not prepared for any ceasefire or start of any peace negotiations. But it is interesting, because China's now pushing, it's on a peace tour, if you will. They've now recently established this agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran to restore diplomatic relations, which is quite important. They want to now have an agreement between Iran and GCC. And the reason I bring this up is it's quite important, because once you pick a hole in an alliance, and this is the anti-Iranian alliance, you see it slowly collapsing. For example, the head of Mossad came out and then said after this, perhaps we need also new policy towards Iran. We need to resolve our differences. So you don't want to be the last country left in an alliance against a country. And I think the same applies with Ukraine. As long as China comes out, it puts a peace proposal, and there's no other proposals on the table. I think once some of the countries begin to look at this, it's possible that the coalition against Russia will start to break up, and some countries will try to come to the table. I mean, for Kiev, they're in quite a difficult position, because as we know, In March, this is when, after the Russians had invaded, within the first couple of days, the Russians they put out a proposal to Ukraine, saying, listen, if you accept these terms, in very broad terms, implement the Minsk agreement, which they should have done in the previous 7 years, then we will withdraw to where we invaded. And what we found out was the Americans and British, they intervened and told the Ukraine not to accept this. Now, the reason for this was, they said, we'll give you all the weapons you want, and you continue to fight, and then you don't have to make a compromise with the Russians. Well, as it turns out now, both the Ukrainians and the Americans have become quite exhausted. But the problem is, Ukraine now is completely dependent on the United States. So I think if China has something to offer the Ukrainians, something like another leg to stand on, a crutch, if you will, then it is possible that they could try to not win them over, but to at least give them an alternative to merely, banging their heads against the wall, because this war is to a large extent already lost. They can't win this anymore. So, again, maybe I'm being too optimistic, but I think from the way I see it, the Chinese have put forward this agreement. The Americans will obviously reject it. The Russians are cautiously approving of it. The Ukrainians, again, this is the wild card. While the Europeans, so far, we're following the Americans on this. But, things can change.
Thank you very much, Mr. Deason. We're running out of time, and I need to ask this last question from Mr. Doctorow. We have less than a minute left, and I know you're going to need a lot more time to give us an answer to this one. But taking all of these different things that we talked about into consideration, do you believe that we're witnessing the creation of a multilateral management system or a new world order?
Well, yes, we definitely are. But it's not going to take place tomorrow. It has to begin somewhere. It has begun on February 24th, 2022, with the launch of the special military operation, which polarized the world, which created an enormous challenge to the American-led West. I slightly regret that the peace proposal of the Chinese was not put forward. It was listed in the joint declaration in section 8 out of 9 sections. I think the Russians and the Chinese have lost an opportunity to wage a peace offensive against the United States.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst from Brussels, and Mr. Glenn Deason, professor of political science from the University of Southeastern Norway from Oslo. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of Spotlight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali,
Peace be upon you, O Abba Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the 9th divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam lived under the wing of his father, the 8th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, for a relatively short period that was not more than 7 years. However, at this young and tender age, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam displayed intelligence and talents that truly astonished the minds of great thinkers. And like his father, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam had been impressed with the greatest of virtues and the highest of morals, the most profound of knowledge and wisdom, and his eternal values became as torches of guidance and awakening in the whole of the Islamic society.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are humbly in your presence talking about these beautiful dialogues of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam, the 9th divinely appointed Imam. From among the various conversations and the various subjects of the conversations that the divinely appointed Imam, the Immaculate Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam had. In one such conversation, he speaks about how one must refrain from committing sins. Now, we must keep in mind the context of the time and era in which this divinely appointed Imam was living. As we have said in some of our programs, the Abbasid governmental establishment, due to its own moral and ethical decadence and corruption, and really their corruption in many different facets and aspects of political and social life, the Muslim Ummah and the Muslim community, the people also were faced with moral and ethical corruption and the various other corruptions as well. And this is usually very natural for this thing to occur because it is the governmental establishment, it is the rulers, it is the governors who are the managers of society. And so if the managers of society are corrupt, then of course society will also follow that same trend. Now, this is why we find that Imam al-Jawad, in this certain instance, he really emphasizes and focuses on this fact and this idea that we must not commit sin. Now, sometimes we consider not committing sin to be